Imagine for a second that an autonomous drone strikes an oil tanker navigating a narrow 29-mile stretch of water thousands of miles away from you.
Right.
And by the time you wake up and pour the morning coffee, the ripples of that single event have already altered the price of the gas in your car, shifted the interest rate on the mortgage you're trying to get, and delayed the microchips needed for your company's new product launch.
It happens fast.
It really does. I mean,
Yeah.
it re September 2026, and the morning news can feel incredibly disjointed. We see overlapping global crises, economic whiplash, technological leaps, and it's very easy to view all these events as isolated
Oh,
incidents.
yeah, absolutely.
So to help you make sense of this, to sort of connect the dots and find the actual signal and all that noise, we are opening up a massive, freshly published document for today's deep dive. It's called The World in 2026: Comprehensive Geopolitical Strategic Assessment.
And it is a staggering piece of work, frankly. I mean, the research cutoff was literally just days ago in early September
This is for
2026.
fresh.
Yeah, exactly. The authors have pulled together this breathtaking amount of data. We're evaluating everything from nuclear arsenals to the supply chains for critical minerals, just to paint a complete picture of the global operating system.
And our mission for this deep dive is to essentially act as your filter. We are skipping the academic jargon, cutting through the endless punditry, and extracting the absolute most critical strategic realities shaping your world right this second.
Right, because you need the actual facts.
Exactly. And to set the baseline for this conversation, we kind of need to completely throw out the old maps. Like, we are no longer living in a unipolar world where the US dictates everything.
No, definitely not.
But this also isn't some clean Cold War 2.0 where the globe is neatly split down the middle, right?
Right. The assessment provides a defining framework right in the executive summary, actually. It officially labels our current global system as competitive, fragmented multipolarity organized around a U.S.-China structural rivalry.
That is a mouthful.
It is. But it means we are basically watching the entire international order being relayered in real time.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because competitive, fragmented multipolarity sounds like a phrase engineered to put an undergraduate political science class to sleep.
Fair enough, yeah.
What does that actually look like on the ground? Because for the last few years, the dominant headline has been that globalization is dead, that the major powers are completely decoupling their economies.
Well, the underlying data totally shatters that narrative. I mean, people are still trading and money is definitely still moving around.
Right.
Like, global foreign direct investment, or FDI, actually rose 6% to about $1.6 trillion in
Oh,
2025.
what's going up?
Yeah, exactly. So what has actually happened is more of a philosophical shift. We are moving away from the era of free trade and into an era of managed strategic trade.
Managed strategic trade.
Right. The assessment introduces this idea that we are now living in a choke point economy.
A system of weaponized interdependence, basically.
Precisely. The assumption used to be that if countries intertwine their economies, the cost of conflict would be too high to ever fight.
The whole Golden Arches theory, right? If we both have McDonald's, we won't go to war.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But now national security establishments are looking at those very same intertwined trade networks and realizing they are massive vulnerabilities to be exploited. Just look at the International Energy Agency data that they cite in this report. China currently accounts for more than 90% of global refining for critical minerals.
90%.
Yeah, more than 90. We're
Yeah.
talking about materials like gallium, graphite, manganese, and rare earths.
I want to stop on that for a second because those materials are in literally everything from your smartphone to an electric vehicle to like the guidance system of an advanced missile.
Oh, yeah, they're the backbone of modern tech.
Right. But I hear people push back on this all the time. They say, well, there are rare earth deposits in Australia and the US, so we'll just dig new
It's
mines.
not that simple, though.
Why not? Why doesn't that solve the dependency?
Because pulling the dirt out of the ground is only step one. And honestly, it's the easy part. The actual choke point is the midstream processing. Refining these minerals requires incredibly specialized chemical engineering knowledge, which China has spent decades perfecting.
Ah, so it's the know-how.
It's the know-how and it's the environment. Furthermore, the refining process produces massive amounts of toxic byproducts.
Oh, right. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, so standing up a new processing facility in a Western country means navigating years of complex environmental permitting and fighting local opposition. You can't just throw billions of dollars at a domestic supply chain and expect to flip a switch. It takes years to build that specialized industrial capacity.
It really feels like the global economy is this giant high-stakes board game.
Yeah.
And in this game, one player, China, has successfully bought up all the raw materials in the factories.
Right.
But the other player, the United States, owns all the banks. Because the U.S. doesn't rely on physical minerals for its leverage, it counters with a financial choke point.
That's a great analogy. Because the U.S. dollar remains the undisputed king of global finance. As of early 2026, the dollar still makes up 57.13% of allocated official foreign exchange reserves globally.
Let's break down the nuts and bolts of why that matters. How does a currency reserve percentage translate into actual power over another country?
It comes down to how money actually moves across borders.
Yeah.
Most large-scale international trade is invoiced in dollars.
Okay.
So if a business in country A wants to buy a massive shipment of goods from country B, they likely need to settle that transaction in U.S. dollars.
Right, makes sense.
And to do that, the money usually has to pass through a correspondent bank, which is a financial institution that holds accounts in the United States and operates under U.S. jurisdiction.
I see where this is going.
Yeah, because the U.S. government has regulatory authority over those banks. It can essentially freeze a nation or a corporation out of the global trading system just by cutting off their access to dollar clearing.
Wow.
Yeah, that gives the U.S. unparalleled sanctions power.
But wait, if everyone is hyper aware of these vulnerabilities, like if China knows the U.S. can cut off its money and the U.S. knows China can cut off its minerals, why is the assessment predicting technological bifurcation?
I mean,
well, the report suggests we are heading toward entirely separate tech stacks for different regions. I think that knowing you are so dependent on someone would force you to keep working together.
Well, what's fascinating here is that national governments have fundamentally decided that economic efficiency is no longer their ultimate goal.
Really?
Yeah. For the last 30 years, the global supply chain was built on just-in-time delivery. You found the absolute cheapest place on earth to assemble a microchip, and you did it there.
Right, maximizing profit.
Exactly. But today, states are willing to accept massive economic inefficiency. They're willing to spend billions of dollars to duplicate supply chains entirely within their own borders or with trusted allies, purely in exchange for security.
So they're basically paying a premium for peace of mind, even if the final product costs twice as much to produce.
Exactly. And that premium is showing up in inflation data globally. We're moving from just in time to just in case.
Just in case. I like that phrase. So seeing as the U.S. and China are the two primary players holding these massive choke points, let's take a look under the hood of both nations.
Let's do it.
Because depending on which news channel you watch, the narrative wildly swings between America is collapsing and China is achieving global domination, or vice versa.
Right. It's very polarized.
Very. So how strong are these two titans really in September 2026?
Starting with the United States, the assessment concludes it is objectively still the top global power.
Okay.
No other state combines its global military reach, reserve currency dominance, deep capital markets, leadership in frontier tech like artificial intelligence, and a worldwide alliance network.
That's quite a list.
It is. And to maintain that the U.S. spent an estimated $954 billion on defense in 2025 alone.
Wait, nearly $1 trillion in a single year. That's a staggering figure.
It is. But the report points to a massive looming vulnerability for the U.S. And it is not military. It is fiscal. Gross federal debt recently crossed the $40 trillion mark.
$40 trillion.
Yeah. Debt held by the public is sitting at roughly 101% of GDP. And under current baselines, it is projected to hit 120% by 2036.
See, I can hear people saying, well, the U.S. borrows in its own currency so the government can just print more money to pay it off.
People say that all the time.
Right. But there's a mechanical consequence to that debt load, isn't there? How does a $40 trillion national debt actually weaken a military superpower?
The mechanism is something economists call crowding out. When the U.S. government runs massive deficits, it has to issue treasury bonds to finance that spending.
Right.
Investors buy those bonds because they are safe. But that means there is less capital available to invest in private businesses. So to attract money, corporations have to offer higher interest rates. Government borrowing essentially makes it more expensive for a civilian company to get a loan to build a new factory or fund research.
That makes sense.
On top of that, as the debt grows, the interest payments on that debt take up a larger and larger slice of the federal budget. Eventually, finding the political will to sustain a $1 trillion defense budget becomes incredibly difficult when you are spending a massive chunk of your tax revenue just paying the interest on your past borrowing.
So the U.S. is immensely powerful, but dragging a very heavy fiscal anchor.
Exactly.
What about across the Pacific?
The assessment offers a highly nuanced view of China. The state is plateauing in several macroeconomic areas, but rising rapidly in industrial and military capacity.
I have to play the skeptic here.
Go for it.
You read reports about China having a crashing property market, weak domestic demand, and according to this very assessment, they are facing a demographic cliff. I think it projected them to lose 204 million people by 2054.
That's correct, yeah.
So how can a country be rising and declining at the exact same time?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, falling into the binary trap of rising versus declining is just the wrong way to analyze national power.
Okay.
A nation can have a shrinking population and a real estate sector that is absolutely dragging down its overall GDP while simultaneously functioning as the most terrifying industrial powerhouse on Earth.
So they are decoupling their own internal economy, basically.
In a way, yeah. China is essentially taking its immense manufacturing base and converting it directly into military leverage.
They don't care if the civilian housing market is booming as long as their factories can build warships faster than any other country in history.
The numbers absolutely back that up. In 2025, Chinese yards produced 56.1% of global commercial shipbuilding output.
Wait, commercial shipbuilding? How does building cargo ships translate into military dominance?
Think about the physical infrastructure required to build half of the world's commercial ships. You have massive dry docks, deeply integrated supply chains for marine engines, and an army of highly skilled maritime welders and engineers.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if a conflict breaks out, a commercial shipyard can be rapidly repurposed to build or repair naval frigates and destroyers.
That is a massive advantage.
Huge.
Yeah.
A country that doesn't have a commercial shipbuilding industry has to build naval vessels from scratch with bespoke supply chains at an enormous premium.
Right.
China's civilian industrial scale gives them a direct mobilization advantage for their navy. And at the same time, they're undergoing a rapid nuclear expansion. They're moving from a historically small retaliatory posture to an estimated 620 warheads by early 2026, complete with large new missile silo fields.
Which means the broader economy might be slowing down, but the pointy end of the spear is getting sharper and heavier.
Exactly.
And these theories of industrial power and financial leverage, they are no longer just hypothetical. They're actively colliding in real ongoing conflicts.
The assessment is totally unflinching in how it examines the active battlefields testing these systems.
And I want to pause here for a second just to set the parameters for how we're talking about this with you, our listener.
Good idea.
Yeah, because when we look at the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war or the U.S.-Israel-Iran conflict of early 2026, the daily news is rightfully focused on the deep human and political realities of those events. But for the purpose of this deep dive, we are leaving the politics at the door.
Completely.
We aren't taking any sides. We are strictly looking at the cold, objective military and economic mechanics laid out in the assessment, because understanding how these wars are fought is vital to understanding the global system.
Absolutely. And the fundamental shift identified in both of these conflicts is that the math of warfare has changed.
The math of warfare.
Right. For decades, military planners obsessed over peacetime inventories. The strategy was focused on how many exquisite billion-dollar platforms like stealth bombers or advanced destroyers a nation had on day one of a conflict.
Right. What's in the garage?
Exactly. But the reality of modern combat has forced a shift toward a focus on replacement rates.
So it's not about the shiny inventory you start with. It's about your industrial capacity to stamp out artillery shells, drones, and interceptor missiles on week 40 of a grueling war.
Look at the dynamics between Russia and Ukraine. Russia has fundamentally adapted into a war economy. The assessment estimates they're spending roughly 7.5% of their GDP, which is about 16 trillion rubles in 2025. Just on defense.
That is massive.
It is. Now, that severely distorts their civilian economy, and it carries heavy long-term demographic costs.
Yeah.
But mechanically, it allows them to sustain the mass production of basic munitions.
And Ukraine.
Ukraine, on the other hand, has shown incredible tactical innovation.
Yeah.
But structurally, they remain highly dependent on Western finance and Western air defense interceptors.
This leads to a brutal attritional stalemate. It's a pure contest of industrial endurance.
And that industrial endurance is deeply connected to a completely different theater, the Middle East.
Yeah.
The direct escalation in the U.S.-Iran conflict in early 2026 proves that traditional energy geopolitics are far from dead.
Here's where it gets really interesting. We hear nonstop discussions about the green energy transition, right? Electric vehicles, solar grids, and yet the entire global economy is still essentially held hostage by a 29-mile-wide stretch of water in the Middle East.
Strait of Hormuz.
The report notes it handles 20 million barrels of oil every single day, plus 19% of global liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
It's a massive bottleneck.
Just the credible threat of a disruption in that strait sends shipping insurance skyrocketing, which raises the cost of goods, which fuels global inflation.
This raises an important question about how these supposedly separate regions interact. Because the conflict in the Middle East directly strains the ability of the U.S. and Europe to supply Ukraine.
Wait, how so? The theaters are thousands of miles apart.
Because both theaters are consuming the exact same highly scarce resource, air defense interceptors.
Ah, the missiles.
Right.
Whether you are defending a Ukrainian city from a Russian missile strike or defending a commercial vessel in the Red Sea from a drone swarm, you are firing the same sophisticated interceptor missiles.
Oh.
And you can only fire a Patriot missile once.
Right. You can't reuse it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The industrial base in the West, which was optimized for peacetime efficiency, simply cannot manufacture replacement interceptors as fast as they are being consumed in two simultaneous conflicts. The replacement rate is the bottleneck.
So with the heavyweights, the US, China, Russia, Europe, bogged down in these high-stakes tech and proxy wars, burning through their capital and munitions, what is happening to the rest of the world? Because this gridlock among the superpowers actually creates massive leverage for middle powers, right?
Definitely. The assessment makes a very firm point on this. We need to permanently retire the term Global South.
Really?
Yeah, it is a flawed label because it implies a unified bloc with shared goals, which simply doesn't exist.
I mean, that makes sense. Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and Vietnam don't suddenly have the exact same strategic ambitions just because they aren't the US or China.
Exactly. Instead of acting as a bloc, these nations are pursuing a strategy the report calls strategic option value.
Strategic option value.
They deliberately avoid picking a permanent side. They want to buy advanced American weapons, build their domestic infrastructure using Chinese state funds, and fuel their industrial grids with discounted Russian energy all at the exact same time.
It kind of reminds me of the modern gig economy.
How so?
Well, none of these middle powers want the restrictive full-time employment of a Cold War-style treaty alliance. They don't want a boss telling them who they can and cannot trade with. They just want to take the best, most lucrative contracts from whoever happens to be offering the best terms on any given day.
That analogy holds up perfectly, actually.
Yeah.
Just take India, which the report identifies as the ultimate swing power in this new system.
Right.
Their economy grew at 7.8% in the second quarter of 2026. Strategically, they are a member of the Quad dialogue with the U.S., Japan, and Australia, yet they remain fiercely anti-alliance.
They want their cake and to eat it too?
Basically, they continue to purchase massive amounts of Russian oil, and they are leveraging a massive youth demographic advantage right as China's population ages. They are playing the field to maximize their own growth.
And we are seeing a similar shift in posture from traditional established allies too, like Europe and Japan. They are rearming at historic rates. I think NATO is aiming to spend 5% of GDP on defense and resilience by 2035.
They are.
And Japan is entirely overhauling its defense posture and expanding its counterstrike capabilities.
The report categorizes their trajectory as seeking autonomy inside alliance.
Autonomy inside alliance.
Right. Europe and Japan are building up massive conventional military forces because they realize they need to take on more of their own security burden. But they still fundamentally rely on the ultimate security guarantee of the U.S. nuclear umbrella. They want more operational independence, but they aren't fully breaking away.
So why are we seeing this massive shift away from centralized global institutions? Like, why is every nation suddenly hedging its bets and building its own bespoke networks?
Because the universal institutions designed to manage global security are largely paralyzed. The UN Security Council is structurally frozen by vetoes the moment any major power centrists are involved.
Right. The vetoes just stop everything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The assessment points at a really telling statistic, actually. UN peacekeeper deployments have dropped to a 25-year low of just 78,633 personnel.
Wow. To 25-year low.
Yeah. When the big universal system fails to provide, security states are pushed toward a la carte groupings.
Pick and choose.
Exactly. You join BRICS for economic coordination and signaling. You join AUKUS to get your hands on advanced submarine technology. You build overlapping custom networks instead of relying on one global umbrella.
So what does this all mean for you? We've covered a lot of ground today, from nuclear silos and commercial dry docks to the intricate mechanics of dollar clearing. But how does this actualize in your day-to-day life?
It's all connected.
The reality is that this web of competitive interdependence is tethered directly to your wallet. When a nation decides to restrict the export of gallium, the microchips required for the car you want to buy become significantly more expensive.
Yep.
When a drone strikes a tanker near the Strait of Hormuz, that energy shock ripples out into the global economy, forcing central banks to keep inflation in check, which means the interest rate on your mortgage stays high. You are living inside the consequences of this strategic assessment every time you check out at the grocery store or apply for a loan.
The physical and economic connections are completely inescapable.
Oh.
But if I can leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Please do.
We have spent our time today analyzing physical choke points. We've talked about the straits, the shipping lanes, the interceptor missiles, and the minerals.
Right.
But the technology section of this assessment contains a stark warning about quantum technology.
The ultimate wild card.
Exactly. We've built this delicate, hyper-complex balance of global power and finance entirely on digital systems secured by modern cryptography.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to this entire geopolitical order on the day a technological discontinuity in quantum computing is achieved? A leap in processing power so profound that it instantly renders the encryption of the entire global financial system completely obsolete.
The ultimate paradigm shift. If you thought the morning news was overwhelming today, just wait until the foundational digital trust that secures every dollar trade and secret evaporates overnight.
It's not the base case for tomorrow morning, but it is exactly the kind of nonlinear shock this complex system is highly vulnerable to.
It definitely forces you to view the daily headlines through a completely different lens. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the narratives, keep looking beneath the surface of the news, and we'll catch you next time as we keep trying to make sense of this deeply complex world.